All right.
Gaul is a tricky thing. And if you're honest about entering... Oh, sure. If you're honest about entering this whole world, right, intellectual honesty, really important to life is the ethics of a lot of people. You'd be surprised how ideology clouds intellectual honesty and how silly, simplistic, and even stupid people become when they suspend their intellectual honesty because they want to arrive at a certain conclusion without thinking. So it's like shooting an arrow or drawing the target after you shoot the arrow. So for example, should Haredim serve in the army, which I'm not going to talk about? Of course they don't have to. 99% of the sources say they don't. I serve in the army. I believe that position. My kids serve in the army. Tell me them. But if you start with the Makaros are no. Now let's get down to how to understand the Makaros. And do they apply? Do they not apply? But just to simply mouth off and say, oh, what they're talking about. And they're all foolish. And just be humble, closely honest. You don't have a monopoly on the truth. It's because you've been brainwashed that your way is the only way. Doesn't mean it is the only way. There are smart people out there that feel different. You have your own Masara. Stick to your own Masara. But at least have enough self-respect not to put your foot in your mouth by saying stupid things. So the same thing, it's a nice introduction to Gula. Everyone talks about Gula, and it's intoxicating, it's all drink the wine, all drink the Kool-Aid. A lot of issues to work through. I'm in the process of writing a book on it. Hopefully it will come out soon. Vocabulary, what are the issues, what are the balances, a lot to talk about. Okay, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to wait for Mashiach, but knows that redemptive fervor can easily become redemptive fever. And just like it can electrify, it can also electrocute. Those are two good phrases for my book to keep them in the back of my mind. Fervor and fever, electrify and electrocute. That's why when our Nevi'im wanted to try to give us a roadmap for Gula, they were thwarted each time. Yaakov wanted to describe exactly Acharit HaYamim and what will happen and how it will happen. Famous Rashi in the beginning of Parshas Vayechi. That's why Parshas Vayigash and Parshas Vayechi are jammed normally between two sedros, or any parsha, not just the sedra. When I say a parsha, I mean the end of a section, the end of a paragraph. It can either end with a pei or a samach, a parsha pesucha or a parsha stuma. There are at least 9 empty spaces that separate parshios. If the empty spaces continue to the end of the line, then it's a parsha pesucha. If the empty spaces are between text, empty space, text, it's called the Parsha Stuma. We have Masara, which Parsha is Stuma, which Parsha is Psucha. Now, every Sedra, Achremos, Kedoshim, Bahar, Bechakosa, Yisro, Mishpatim, have a Parsha separating them, so it's easy to find in the Torah. You need to look for the space. Between Vayigash and Vayichi, there are no 9-letter spaces. It's enjammed. Vayachazuba, the last 2 words of Parsha is Vayigash, Vachi Yaakov, Beretz Mitzrayim. So there's no space. So Rashi says, why is there no space? Lama Parshas are Stuma, the first Rashi in Parshas Vayechi. Because Bikesh, Oso Tzadik, Legalos Es Haketz, Yaakov wanted to reveal the end of days. V'nistalik Shechina Emenu. Hashem pulled the plug. I don't want you to share this information. Yaakov lived at a seam of history, a Tefer Histori. Because we're entering a stage of Galus. When you enter Galus, you start thinking about where's the exit strategy? When do we leave and how do we leave? Because of that, he wanted to share the details. Hashem said, no, nada, don't. The same thing happens at the next seam of history. We went to the first Galus. And Daniel, who's then the Navi, has chalomed. He wants to share. Hashem says, v'chasam, just leave it as concealed information. It's not something. Now, why Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want us to know, and why is it so mysterious? Many, many, many reasons, okay? At a practical level, whenever messianic expectations rage and they're dashed, and if we're too messianic, we see Mashiach coming at every corner. Every time there's a crisis, or every time there's a battle, or any time there's an intifada, or any time there's an inquisition, all of a sudden, it must be a sign that Mashiach is coming. And of course, the greatest tragedies in history have been based on false messiahs, raised unrealistic expectations, and those expectations are dashed. Disheartening and national crisis. What's the most famous false messiah that plunged Am Yisrael into a terrible? Shabtai Tzvi, 1666. No, it lasted about 100 years. 100-year depression after Shabtai Tzvi. 18th century German Jewry is one of the worst places to be in our Galus. It was a complete circus. Anyway, not just German, but the entire Europe, but German was the center of a lot of many, many different controversies. Okay. Another reason is not just dashed expectations, but also because it leads to escapism. Jews have this very delicate art of balancing between not confrontationalism, but heroism and being and dreaming and vision. Right? So we dream of the next world, and that's the palace, and this is just the passageway. But we don't ignore the passageway. We live in the passageway. Some people less engaged in the passageway. Some people are more engaged in the passageway. But there are some religions that preach otherworldliness, transcendentalism, transcend this world, be somewhere else. Nirvana, let's say, many Eastern religions. Some religions are completely locked in this metal and concrete jungle, which we call New York City, which we call the urban modern world, and they've abdicated any vision of somewhere else. We're very, very delicately perched. We build families. We raise farms and chickens. We participate in finance and culture, progress in science, civilization, and, of course, spirituality. But, of course, we know this is a passing, transient world. We don't get too engrossed in this world because it's all going to fade. So why invest in something which is so temporal? So we're very, very delicately perched. So we're not just perched between two worlds. We're also perched between two eras. We live in this world. Try to advance it. We make peace with our reality. We try to excel within our reality. But we all know that this is a fallen world. And as hard as we try, it's not the utopia we wish for. So, for example, democracy is great. Don't idolize democracy. It's the best form of government we've been capable of generating. All the Americans, when they're in camp, they'll celebrate July 4th with red, white, and blue cupcakes or whatever. Democracy has its fair share of drawbacks, flaws, bastard children, cultural contamination. Okay, it's the best form. You have to support it. We have to advance it. We can't deify it. Okay, we don't pray for a democracy. When Mashiach comes, not going to be a vote. Rosh Baruch is getting stolen as the monarch. So we do our best. The raging issue now in Israel is more or less around that pivot. Should it be, how do we find the balance between a democratic society and a Jewish society? Because there are points of conflict. And every single religious Jew has to be on the right side of that equation. We want a Jewish state that protects democratic values. Okay, and that means that we have a fair share, 98% of democracy in Israel will resemble democracy elsewhere. But there are certain elements of democracy that we can't support because we want a Jewish spirit to the state, or Jewish Shabbos, however you define that, whatever. And again, it's not as if it's not the most difficult conflict. It's that level-headed people sat around the table, even people want democracy first and Judaism second, the points of conflict are so minimal that you could solve them with goodwill and cooperative spirit. But in the end, the way we see our world, democracy is not the highest value. People use democracy as a conversation ender. Oh, it's not democratic. Maybe. Doesn't make it invalid. It's because it's not democratic. Doesn't mean that's the end of the conversation. Democracy is not the highest value. It's a value that we're... Or Emir Hashem, I hope this doesn't apply to any of you, but many of you may have the challenge of being living between two worlds. Not just Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba, not just our fallen world and Yemos and Mashiach, but between living in Teaneck or London and making peace with the fact that you have to live there maybe your whole life, but knowing that you really belong here. And some people are unable to embrace the reality, and some people are so entrenched in their reality, they can't even envision maybe I should be somewhere else. And it takes a mature imagination to say, I'm living where I live. I have parents that need me. I'm not ready to make Aliyah. My marriage can't withstand it. My finances can't withstand it. Whatever the story is, I should be somewhere else, but right now I can't be. You know what? That's the story of life. I wish I could be better than I am right now. And I'm trying every day to be better, but I know that when this day ends, I'm not going to be as great as I'd like to be. So I have to dream, but also accept my reality. And somewhere life, success, and emotional well-being sits right at the seam between ambition and acceptance. Without ambition, you sink into mediocrity. Without acceptance, you sink into depression because you can't reach all your goals. They remain forever elusive. So you have to learn how to balance between those two. Ambition, aspiration, acceptance of who you are within reason. Okay, so that's another reason. Too much messianism, too much escapism, too much... There's another danger called antinomianism, which we are facing now in Israel. And be very, very careful. It's a very toxic, poisonous culture, even amongst religious Zionists, called that is the Gullus way of doing things. We have the Eretz Yisrael way of doing things. When people start talking like that, you start walking out of the room. Promise that someone, get out as fast as you can, because you are on a sinking ship. Okay, Eretz Yisrael is expanding and amplifying and adding, but chas v'shalom, not replacing, and that terminology is offensive. It's offensive to 2,000 years of Jews who sometimes showed more faith than people that are now have the pride and the joy of living in Eretz Yisrael. They live in the harsher conditions and they maintain. So it's a combination. Jewish history didn't begin in 1948. It's a very, very poisonous view amongst a lot of homegrown Israelis that look down on people from Chutz La'aretz and, oh, we are basket cases and charity cases. I don't know where they're getting that from. That's the way we look at Jews sometimes. I don't look at anyone that way, but there's great pride in making Aliyah, there's great pride in our communities, and there's great pride in being Jewish, and to be very, very careful. So that's why the whole Kitnios issue was so explosive. Okay, do I think Kitnios at some point will fade? Probably. But everything has a time and a place. And do I think the Neschos of Svarad and Ashkenaz will merge? Probably. But change, as we've talked about so often, is not if, but more important, when and how. And you're seeing this right now here. Don't be careful not to be flag wavers. Let things evolve. Let things take their time, because these are complex situations. Change is always volatile, and it can explode and erupt and scuttle everything that's been built until now. And how do you segue gradually into new phases without tossing out the old accomplishments? It's so hard, and you as women are going to have to face that, because you're at the forefront of the change in our society. And how do you maintain? Just simple things of motherhood. How do you introduce Torah learning for women without ruining motherhood? Not just time and how many hours, but the profile. Will women who are, let's say, excelling in Talmud Torah get the same satisfaction and meaning for being a great mother? Because the Kodesh Baruch Hu gave you maternal instincts, he didn't give me. And it has nothing to do with who's going to babysit or make dinner. There's a certain message and conveyance and mother's milk that you can deliver that I can't. I remember looking at my wife sometimes being jealous, that I couldn't nurse. And obviously, I can't nurse because biologically I can't, but there's some relationship and language that I don't have, that I can't convey, that I'll never know. And there's something that I can't give my kids. So how will that happen? There's so many different areas. And the easiest thing is to be a revolutionary. Put your arm up and say, let's tackle the fortress and break everything down because it's old and it's fossilized. Learn how to be institutionalist. Learn how to work within, and sometimes it's the pace. It's just a second. So the same thing here. So I get all queasy when people start saying, well, Kitnios, that's a relic of Gullus. Now we're in Eretz Yisrael. Well, slow down. Okay? I promise you, your statements are going to be a relic one day because you're on the wrong side of history. You're a relic, not Kitnios. Now, if you tell me that part of moving back is slowly but surely moving into a different stage of Minhagim, not just wrecking Minhagim by assigning them as Gullus, but Minhag has its own dynamic, and so Minhag changes, and it's appropriate for Minhagim to change, and now they're in Eretz Yisrael, and what does it have to say about Kitnios? Is there really a division in Kitnios in New York City and Eretz Yisrael? Right? But for example, my Minhag is to wear tefillin in Chalamoy. That's a dying Minhag. My kids are not going to wear tefillin in Chalamoy. In Chutz Laretz, there are different Minhagim. Some men wear tefillin in Chalamoy, some don't. In Eretz Yisrael, the Minhag slowly but surely evolve, and no one wears tefillin. So I wear tefillin in private. I go home, I put on tefillin, no one sees. I went through it before Hesia. My kids don't, because I still maintain my family Minhag. But now that my kids are being raised in Eretz Yisrael, they're not going to have that Minhag. So Minhagim can change. And will the issue of Kitnios change now that Svaradim are here and they never had the Minhag? So it's not that you're saying, oh, the Gullus Minhag. You're saying, well, now we're living with Svaradim, and now we're living with families, and maybe there are issues of Kavod HaBrios and family unity that at this point should take precedence over Minhagim. And to what degree can those issues be projected onto large scale in our community, in our makolas, in our supermarkets? Okay, let's see how this works over, you know, two or three generations. Let's see if it's being said by responsible poskim who know Torah well and have that feel for how halacha changes, or it's just people who just want to dis chachamim and subvert rabbinical authority, and this is just the first way to do it. So there are a lot of issues to work through with redemption. That's why I want these shiurim not just to be campfires and rallies, oh, we're redeemed, the Reishis Michatz Gula Seinu, and 15 other cliches that no one knows what they're talking about. But let's drill down and think about what are the opportunities, what are the paths, what are the challenges of Gula, why is it taking so slow, what do we feel like? Let's try to take three, four shiurim that we have and as best we can pay some attention. Thank you for your patience. You need redemptive patience also.
I really agree with what you're saying a lot. It's like one of the most frustrating things for me as an Olah is like stop invalidating 2,000 years of our history. But like, how do you slow down? Like, I agree with you that things need to be slower, but like how, I think that there is a passion that's beautiful, but also misplaced a little bit in terms of like, we're in Israel, so we're being Israel now. Like, how do you, do you know what I'm saying?
Well, I've said this before to people. If I had $10 million, I would start a program. I'd call it reverse birthright. I'd send children of Anglo-Olim back to their parents' communities to see where their parents came from.
Yeah.
And they appreciate it. Israelis have such a naive sense of what's happening in Chutz Laaretz. They don't know these sweet, especially in America. And they really think there are a few Jews living, maybe a restaurant here or there, and a shul here or there. And it's not just America. They don't realize it. It's a very simplistic thinking. Patriotism and nationalism and fervor, and always. It's not just true about Zionism. It's true about any ideology and any one position. Learn to be balanced. What I think you're getting in this institution is there are many, many particles to the mosaic of truth. And if you just take the one and you protect it, the greatest errors in life are not falsehood. Listen to this line because you'll hopefully use it and think about it the rest of your life. The greatest errors in life are not falsification, but presenting partial truths as complete truths. So learn to say there are many, many, many values, and Baruch Hashem, the passion, the patriotism, the renewal, and then the tradition and the legacy and the heroism and the so Baruch Hashem. I think do I think that Anglo-Olim are going to make a cultural change in Israel? No, you're not even a drop in the bucket. And with all the Nefesh excitement, the Mizrahi excitement, Anglo-Olim make a small, small fraction of this culture. Russian Olim has strong influence, French Olim has strong influence, of course, Sephardic Olim has strong influence. Those are the major cultures that are impacting Israel. But in your own world, in your own heart, in your own friends, certainly in your own heart, you realize that the past 2,000 years not a blip on the radar or historical parentheses. Yeah, I don't think all of a sudden you get up and change the world's opinion. Okay? Or not the world, but our culture's opinion. Okay, so having said all that, let's start thinking a little redemptively. Let's start looking at past snapshots of redemption. Because everything in Jewish history is cyclical. Everything. One of the big differences between the Western view of history and the Jewish view of history is that Western civilization views history as open-ended, undetermined, evolutionary, progressive. These are the impulses that you've been fed. We're cycling to a better reality. Each generation reaches new achievements and new standards and new milestones that previous generations did not. And of course, we don't see it that way. We see Jewish history as predetermined, cyclical, and the terminus very much resembles the Genesis. Namely, we're cycling back to Chadei Shemenu Kekedem. That doesn't mean it's going to be goats and sandals and we're going to eat... No, we'll still have cars, we'll still have technology, we'll still have... But the spirit, the moral spirit... religious spirit, the spirit of fraternity, the spirit will be reclaiming an ancient spirit that has been degraded. And that's what makes being a frum, but also a modern Jew, and I hate terminologies, because everyone's a modern Orthodox Jew, right? You can't not be, right? If you're Orthodox, then you're modern. You're living in a modern world by these labels. So they're humiliatingly simplistic, so I avoid that, right? Every day you're more of a modern Orthodox Jew than the day before because you're in a more modern world. Yeah. I don't know what it means. But people that embrace the modern world, let's say, as opposed to people that villainize the modern world, and let's say a lot of people in Haredi-oriented cultures have a villainization. There's a long tradition of villainization. It starts in the 19th century where everything became villainized and there was a lot of threats to Orthodox Judaism. Remember the 19th century is the most traumatic century for religion in general, and for Judaism in particular. It's the first time you have large populations of Orthodox Jews defecting voluntarily. Before the 19th century, you had individuals who walked out. They were the heretic. Hi, I'm Elisha ben Avuya. Hi, I'm Spinoza. Goodbye, we don't want to see you anymore. And you walked out of Judaism. Or you had communities leaving, but through coercion. Muranos, conversos, people who were compelled to leave Judaism. For the first time in history, remember, the Tzedukim and the Essenes, they're not walking out in Judaism. If you go back in a time machine, get into your DeLorean and set the time machine, you know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Set the time machine back to the second base of Mikdash and meet at Stuki, they're looking at you as if you're less from than they are. Not as if they were Reformed Jews. These Jews, I mean, again, there's an overlap because they rejected Torah Shabbat in a way that, let's say, similarly, Reformed Jews and conservative Jews have rejected, at least initially, Torah Shabbat, now even parts of the divinity of Torah itself. But they were the firmest people on the block. They went to the mikveh four times a day. They fasted. They didn't have food on Shabbos. They didn't have cold food on Shabbos. They looked at you as left-wing, liberal-leaning, progressive Jews who are walking out of the Judaism through your kulos of the Drabanan. So they didn't walk out of Judaism. They were trying to stiffen the standards and whatever. They were lost to history. The Karaites also. They didn't see themselves as walking out. So, but surely the communities... A split, and they fell off the face of Jewish history. But now it's the 19th century, and everyone's leaving. And some people are leaving for religious denominations, which are breaking with tradition, conservative and then reform. Some people are just leaving entirely. They want to become secular, they want to become Bundist, they want to become social. And of course, there's a lot of bleed over and carry over in between those groups. So just around that time, two things happen. Number one, Hasidus decides, okay, we're going to go insular. The 100-year period of Hasidus is very embracing. Became, we're going to fend off and fight off the other with a capital O. And the other is this whole hobgoblin of secular, Bundist, socialist, reform, conservative. And of course, Zionism gets pasted onto that. If Zionism had emerged in the 16th century, everyone would be a Zionist. Are you kidding? But it came under the cover of secular nationalism. And it came under the trauma of religion in the 19th century. They don't just assume about secular nationalism, which, by the way, that's the simple way to read it. It's not the way I read it, but if you're just looking at connected dots, 19th century, secular nationalism. What's Jewish secular nationalism? Zionism. So it's treif. Like, why would you want to sign up for something that's secular? Again, there are answers to all these questions. We'll get to them. But if you just start with the facts, not with your ideology, that's a way to develop a baseline of intellectual honesty. So there's a great villainization. The second part is the yeshiva world. The yeshiva world is essentially a bunker. Let's create a teva. Let's create an internal world. Let's create internal ethos where Talmud, Torah, Connecticut, Kulam, which we all agree to. And if you're not learning Torah, then you're basically a nothing and you're meaningless. And it's we're in, they're out, and we're going to defend ourselves against the outside world. So there's a tremendous sense of what I call otherization or villainization, where there's other people, so they're the villains. I don't know how I got into this, but whatever. So Jewish history is cyclical, right? So if you're someone that has a Haredi leaning, then you essentially villainize modernity. If you villainize modernity, so the advantage is it's a black and white world. Everything in the past is superior to everything in the future. Everything in the modern world is corrupt, immoral, promiscuous, fallen, contaminated. It's a pretty straight black and white world. The danger of that is it's schizophrenic because you're living in the modern world, right? If you're living in Me'er Sharim, it's pretty easy to take that policy and apply it because you don't really indulge in this world. You live your ideology. You essentially say the whole world around me is fraught with impurity, fraught with immorality, fraught with women not dressing the right way. And basically, I'm not part of that world. I got to drink water, but chicken water, not Coke. I got to live, but I don't have a fancy car. I got to keep Pesach, but I'm eating crusty matzahs, not going to Pesach programs. I'm filling my belly with hot dogs and hamburgers. What's happening, and I fear there's going to be a breakdown at some point, is people who live in the world of modernity and go to sports events and go shopping and go to Pesach programs and live the luxury, but they're still parroting villainized versions of the modern world. The modern world is treif, the modern world is treif, the modern world is treif, and then they shut the safer and have a good time in the modern world. At some point, that compartmentalization has to catch up with people. That's what worries me. But that's, you're not charedim, unless you want to. I'll be happy if you want to, but that's not where you are right now. Then there are people who are completely secular, and they also have a black and white monolithic view. Everything modern is great. Everything ancient is fossilized and antiquated. So we live in the world of progress, world of science, world of modernity, world of technology, world of medicine, world of culture, education, politics, everything's progressive. And you know what? Not only that, but Chazal, they're a bunch of cavemen, a bunch of Neanderthals. Like these antiquated shepherds who have these crazy discussions about eggs and oxes, and like, who cares about them? So these are two monolithic, unidimensional views of our tradition. Everything modern is terrible. Everything modern is progressive. Somehow, we have to find the sweet spot and say as follows. Everything modern is superior. Education. We're happy there's literacy. I'm happy people can read. That's a good thing. Right? Women could not read 800 years ago. Of course, Jews were always way ahead of the curve in their literacy because no one could read. We could read, which is part of the reason everyone was jealous of us because we were the literate people on the block. People had to come to the Jews to help them read their bills or their contracts. So we're literate. We're happy. Universal education. Medical care. Much better to deliver antibiotics than to put leeches on people's foreheads. I prefer the antibiotics. Think about the Spanish flu or the Spanish pandemic of the early 20th century and this pandemic. How many people lost their lives then? How many people lost their lives here? Total different. Why? Because we're able to develop vaccines. The next wave, maybe your lifetime, maybe your children's lifetime, they'll laugh at us. They'll say, oh, in the previous COVID-19, they didn't have scanners to see where the virus was. They just had to like make believe you can't touch door handles. They were, now we just have a scanner. Okay, don't go into that room because we can see some viral objects. So they had filters that could filter it out. And whatever, and so don't laugh at the previous generation because you're just setting yourself up to be mocked by the next generation. But we're happy with the medical treatment we have. We're happy with free politics, free thought, mechanization, machination. Next time you use a dishwasher or a newer washing machine, just think about your great-great-grandmother sitting there by the Danube River scraping her fingernails against a metal piece just to clean the shirt. So Baruch Hashem, that's what has led to the liberalization and the emancipation of women, the fact that most of the domestic chores, which you guys used to carry, have now been mechanized. I just press a button, and it just takes care of the chores. So we're happy about all that. But in the moral sphere, in the Torah sphere, there's been a deterioration. Namely, the further you get from the source being Har Sinai, Revelation, the more corruption there is in transmission. That's a scientific statement. It's not a religious statement. Let's say we play broken telephone, and we go around the room, the more that the information gets passed along, the more corrupted it becomes. So somehow we have to be able to have those two ideas in our head at once. That we live in a modern world, which we embrace. We don't villainize. And there are costs for the embrace. Don't get me wrong. If you decide you don't want to embrace the modern world, a lot of Baalei Tshuva, they've become so intoxicated in their previous life, not intoxicated, but so lost in this cultural barrage of drugs and sex and alcohol and indulgence and materialism. Why do you think so few Baalei Tshuva could be balanced Orthodox, not modern Orthodox, balanced Orthodox? They just say, look, I've OD'd on it. I got to go cold turkey. I'm afraid of it. I can't balance myself anymore. The intelligent people will say, I just can't allow myself that luxury. I have to swing to the opposite end of the pendulum. Not so I can balance out in the end, because I've seen the dark side. I'm too suspicious of that dark side. I've been too affected or afflicted by it. I just have to have a life which to me is more Spartan and more self-abnegating and self-deprived, which is, I understand, right? I don't know if any girls here are Baalei Tshuva. You have no Baalei Tshuva. But if you've had a from birth background, more or less balanced, without too much indulgence, too much promiscuity, too much loss of balance, so you have an internal sense that this works. But if you've been too frightened, right? What's the Billy Graham was an American preacher, went around preaching. Billy Graham, you can wiki him tonight. He was a preacher of all the presidents, a Christian preacher, hard principles, Christian values. So one of his lectures, one of his schmoozing, was against alcoholism. So he says, how did he beat alcoholism? He says the first time he and his sister came home drunk in 1922 in Ohio, whenever they've been out, hanging out with their friends at the local bar in Ohio, they came home, their father took them out back, force-fed them alcohol till they threw up, then they never wanted to get near the stuff again. Okay, today that father would be put in jail, but he was pretty effective. He just forcibly fed his children more and more and more beer and wine, and they vomited all. Disgusting. It smells. It stinks. I don't want to get near that again. The rest of my life, I can't. Every time you think you see a bottle of beer, right? It's like meat after Yom HaTzmut. Who wants a big hamburger today, right? How much meat did you guys eat yesterday? My last thing, you guys have the meatballs today, and you see those little meaty fish. I couldn't touch them. I couldn't touch them. I was going near them. Yes, no. The chicken, I said, you know what? I'll just have a fruit or something. And I just had a banana.
The soup was great.
Yeah, the soup. I couldn't. Another hamburger. Another hamburger. Another piece of steak. It was too hard for me. Okay, this is all a good introduction. What were we talking about? I don't know what we're talking about. Right, so Jewish history, cyclical. Cyclical, right? So Jewish history, cyclical. Whereas this is all just introduction. We'll get to it. Maybe once you know what I'm talking about tonight. I don't know what I'm talking about before the next minute. Okay, so let's take a look at source number one. Study past redemptive portraits, and we can appreciate our current redemptive conditions. Okay. Sefer Shmos presents not the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. It presents a story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. The story of Yetzias Mitzrayim is a multi-layered and multi-tiered narrative. For whatever reason, Sefer Shmos suppresses some of that narrative. Doesn't provide all the information for whatever reason. Right, let's say, for example, Mirza Shem, one day you'll get engaged. And you'll write a nice card to your husband. I'll write a nice card to you. He's not going to go over every single date you had. Oh, by the way, remember this date we fought, and that date you had a terrible time, and you were angry with me? You'll highlight the good parts. And you'll ignore the bad parts until some other time. They'll come back to bite you. Like in every marriage, they have to talk about the bad parts at some time. It's like you're saying, oh, happy birthday, you had a great year. And remember that time you really insulted me? No, you skim over. So Shmos is a honeymoon. Shmos is a romance. Shmos is HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us out. He loves us. And we're just a fledgling little child. And we have no say. We've been backbroken. And it smudges over. It fudges over some of the bad stuff. Some of the ugly stuff. But there's ugly stuff about Yitzias Mitzrayim. And some of the other prakim in Tanakh provide alternate narratives. If you really want to know what happened in Mitzrayim, you have to read four or five sections, two or three prakim in Tehillim, two or three prakim in Yechezkel, for example, Tezayin. Today we're going to read the story of Yitzias Mitzrayim that you don't get in Sefer Shmos, that you have to read Yechezkel, Perachaf, to appreciate, but all of a sudden it changes. It changes the entire complexion of Yitzias Mitzrayim. Of course, it's not one complexion. It's a spectrum of different stories that happen, as all of human experiences, and certainly a divine moment, is spectrumed. It's bicolored, many, many colors to it. So Yechezkel Perachaf, redemption, comes with expectations. Bayomahu, look at the first source, Nesasiyas Adilo Tziyam Eretz Mitzrayim. Hashem says, I want to take them out of Mitzrayim. Bamar Lachem, and I told them, Ish Shikur Tzeyanav HaShlichu, Uvilei Mitzrayim Alti Tama. As much as HaKadosh Baruch Hu's might and power can redeem human failure and human nightmares, Hashem wants human beings to have a part in it. Hashem wants us to take some small part, not just to be completely passive and completely apathetic and just wait there helplessly. Hashem wants to empower us. Doesn't want to enfeeble us. Redemption can be very enfeebling, right? Hashem authors the entire process. If you look at Sefer Shmos, it's enfeebling, intentionally. What happened the night of Pesach? Can't leave your home. How quickly did it happen? 6 hours. Did we expect it? No. How do we know when to expect it? We didn't even bake the bread. Like, we were just completely helpless, completely hapless, no role, no authorship, which is what Hashem wanted, because in Sefer Shmos, this is the debut of the Melech Malchei Melechim. Remember you said this a month ago? Ani Hashem, Ani V'lo Shliach, Ani V'lo Malach, Kechazos Allah, Ani Yerzeach Mitzrayim. This is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's game. This is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's debut. No one's on stage. This is just a soliloquy, the Rabbanu Shalom, no one else, no other people on stage. But that's not the only thing that happened. That's the story of Sefer Shmos, the element, the feature of the story that Shmos amplifies and presents. There's another story that's taking place under the surface that Yechezkel highlights, in which Hashem says, make a change, make a move, do something. Now, what can slaves do? They're still shackled, or they're working, but they're still in Mitzrayim. You can't leave. Policemen, guards, how could they? One thing you can do, freedom of conscience. Viktor Frankl. You always can make the free choice. So make a choice. Now, sometimes you have to be brave to make a free choice. That defines. Sometimes to make your choice be known, to express your choice, takes a lot of courage. So Hashem warned them because despite our tendency to sugarcoat the past and to glorify the past at our own expense because we're terrible and they're all great, which is another enfeebling myth, the Jews in Mitzrayim fell pretty fast. They fell pretty hard. They were completely immersed in the pagan culture. They did retain national identity. What were the three markers they maintained? Anyone remember? What were the three?
Clothes, dresses,
language. Clothes,
names,
language. There's a fourth that people don't know, which is really important. It's the social cohesion. They didn't fall into gossiping, social cohesion. They didn't tell Lashon Hara, and they were very sneistic, which is a way to protect human dignity, not to share private issues with one another. So what happens is, two things happen to slaves. One is the food chain effect, that when you're exposed to torture and persecution, you tend to look for someone weaker than yourself to take it out on, right? Just think about parents sometimes, every parent, right? Sometimes parents get frustrated to take it out on children. Think about some of the social dynamics you went through in high school, never having been a high school girl, but I can only imagine what it's like seeing with other eyes, right? You get bullied psychologically, emotionally, but someone stronger than you, wherever you define that, and then you take it out on someone weaker than you. And of course, the art in life is to break that transmission of exploitation. To say, you know what, the way you break it is you become the vent. You're like, just take it. Take it. Take it on your chest. Take it on your body. Be strong enough. Be man enough. Woman enough. Or you tell yourself, be strong enough not to have to parlay it to the next, to absorb the stress rather than transfer the stress to someone else. You're the lightning rod. It comes to you and it dies there. It stops there. It doesn't always work. But that's part of the way you relieve stress in your world. You become a calming influence. You're not going to pass it on. Some people escalate stress. So when stress happens, they multiply it. They exponentially multiply. They take it, they ratchet it up, they pass it on, and the stress multiplies. So slaves tend to have that, right? That's in any dynamic. You feel some of the sad stories of the Sonderkommando, the Jews in concentration camps who were responsible to run the crematory, and some were more heroic, and some were more selfish, and the Judenrat, and these are very explicit situations where you're caught in the middle between two. But even in more subtle situations of exploitation, you're caught between the abuser and your victim, and you have to break the chain of abuse by not transferring it on. So it's very, very easy to be abusive to other people as a slave, and once you're abusive to other people, social cohesion starts to suffer. And they didn't gossip about one another. They protected each other's dignity. The sexual issues were intact. These are some of the issues that you don't read in the matter. So there are five issues, more or less, in this. You've heard about the names, you've heard about the language, you've heard about the clothing, but it was also social cohesion, not gossiping, not being petty, not just getting pleasure from other, you know, women or other. They maintained their dignity and the social cohesion. And that reminded us that sometimes these are values that can platform religious revival. When people say, well, what are we going through today? It's all secular. It's all just nationalistic. It's all just language, Hebrew identity, names, Israel, whatever. It's not really religious. It's secular. Are we living through a similar phenomena where an end is that ideal or is that unfortunate, but Hashem will work with it? That's also an interesting question. Why are we going through this condition where we're creating national identity, hopefully national solidarity, hopefully we're maintaining Jewish pride, hopefully we're building Jewish identity, Israeli identity, which is Jewish but not religious identity, and I believe that this will lead to a religious revival. Is that a better way for Hashem to do it, or it's just the way we forced Hashem to do it because we fell into religious disrepair? But it's only happened in Mitzrayim. They went from having Jewish names and Jewish language to receiving Torah mitzvahs at Har Sinai. Of course, through an act of God. It's not like it just morphed into it naturally, but Hashem had one connect to the other. But religiously, it was a disaster. Religiously, it was a catastrophe. And there was religion to speak of. Avram was a religious person. He believed in monotheism. He believed in morality. He had certain rituals, whether it was Bris Milah, which they tempted to ignore in Mitzrayim, Gid Hanasha, or according to Chazal's more broad description, that our Avos kept the entire Torah. Without getting into that issue and how they acquire that information, I'm convinced that if you go back to Avram, he wasn't just a goat herdsman talking about morality and monotheism. He was talking about Pesach and Matzah and Halachos because it's Hashem's brain, Hashem's Chachma, not brain, but it's Chachma. And Avram was able to access Hashem's Chachma both by seeing it through the world Hashem created and also through supernatural means, the way Chazal say, his two kidneys started to instinctively pour forth Torah. Now, does that mean that, what sugya did you learn today? What Gemara are you like to do in the summer? Bava Kama, the first parak? Now, does that mean that the eighth parak. Yeah. Does that mean that he had the same question of Rashi and the Rush, whether when you access someone like an Eved, is it an Eved Kanani or an Eved Ivri? It's the first machlokas, you'll get to it at some point. Could be, some will say that. The most famous Beis Halevi, right? Because Torah predates this earth. So we believe Torah predates the earth in some other form, permutation, Hashem's will predates the earth. But if you take that literally, Torah predates the earth by 2,000 years, and finish the sentence. We don't eat matzah because we left Mitzrayim on the 15th. What is the chronologically logical way to say that?
We left on the 15th
because Hashem commanded us to eat matzah. Because what came first, the history or the Torah? The Torah. Okay, there are a million different ways to parse that, but I'm just giving you an extreme version of it just to, again, break the stereotypical thinking that there's only one way to see things, and that's the way my Mara taught me in eighth grade, or the way my rabbi believes, or the way my camp instructed me when it was trying to ideologically propagandize me and indoctrinate me. There are many, many ways to think out there. Okay, just intellectual honesty and respect. You're not the only smart person around, and neither is your Marsheva Rosh Eta. There are many other smart people in this world, and even if they disagree with you, they may also know a few things about religion and about Hashem and respect them and find your groove, find your frequency without feeling the need to disdain and disrespect other frequencies. The two don't have to go hand in hand. That's called, there are many ways to slice the tomato or the tomato. And Hashem is this really big infinite tomato, so there are an infinite amount of ways to slice it. And you're just learning how to slice it for yourself. Doesn't have to be the only truth to be your truth. It could be many truths. It's your truth. Okay, learn that. There's one message to take. That's a message to take. There's this great story where Shimon Peres visits the yeshiva, like 1973 or something. I have to find it for you. Do you have Seeking Your Presence? No, it's in an old article. So he asks Rav Lichtenstein, what are the viewpoints of the opinions of the yeshiva? Like, he's basically asking Rav Aaron for, like, what are their politics? Right, left, yes. Rav Aaron has this three, like, stunning says, first of all, to learn there's more than one truth. Second, like, what do you want from your students? Settle the land, conquer the Arabs, serve the others. Shimon wants like simple truths, and Ravon gives him real things about life. There are more than one truth. Learn to disagree with people without disrespecting them as people. Like, learn the complexity of life, learn there's more than one truth, and learn to disagree with someone without disrespecting them. Like, that's so much more important than whether you support this silly, stupid, passing little political agenda or not. Okay? Remember, I was speaking in Shabbos. I kept saying this to people in the community. History, not headlines. History, not headlines. Just repeat yourself again and again. We're going through a historical process. It's going to take a long time. There's going to be setbacks. The headlines, get them out of your head. You want to read the headlines? It's good sport. You want to read shopping? It's also good. You want to watch Shark Tank? It's even better. You know, that's the value I place on headlines. They're all Irish guy. We're involved in some history. Okay, history is partially contributed to by headlines, so we have to be involved in the process. But just because the headlines say this and they said that, and this one said that to that one, that one said that to this one, you know what headlines are slated for? Historical oblivion. They're slated for archives. Okay, 50 years. The headlines of today will be as meaningful as whatever headlines are in archives in 1922, whatever. Right, what really matters are facts on the ground. Facts on the ground are moral decisions and personal conduct, and that's what establishes. That's what creates real, lasting edifices. Everything else is just sandcastles, up and down, up and down, up and down. Okay, so let's get back to Yechezkel. We have to finish one source today. I'm determined to do it, girls, okay? Despite my best efforts. I'm
going to
finish. What?
Can we take bets?
Okay, amongst yourselves, you can take bets. But I get a 10% commission on the winning bet. That's my rule. Okay, no, we have rules. No bets because it's addictive behavior, at least for boys. I'm not sure if it's for girls, but for boys it's very, very addictive. It preys, with an E, on the basic human desire for free lunches. What gambling does is you want to get something for free. There's a basic, deep desire to get a free ticket for it in life, and gambling amplifies that and preys on people's desire. And I'm telling you this not because I think you'll ever gamble, but because you have to train yourself not to ever expect or wait for anything free. Okay, there's a dark, deep need that people have to be freeloaders, to get away with it and get things that they didn't work hard for. And the more that you work on, it's not just, oh, I'm going to steal from so-and-so or eat extra corn. It's more, what's it I'm looking for? Are you happy with what you have, and you don't expect anything? And when you don't expect anything other than what you work for, you won't be disappointed when life doesn't exactly neatly package itself for all your fantasies of what you expected them to give you. You don't deserve anything. You're humble. You work hard for what you have. You appreciate what you have. Anything else, icing on the cake. Icing comes, doesn't come, not going to make a difference in the cake. It's not a question of gambling. Gambling is just a extreme, grotesque version of it. It's a desire to have a lot, to let ambitions run wild without working for it. And it preys on many, many dark features of the human condition. And the more that you work to ratchet down expectations, to ratchet down a sense of deservedness, to ratchet that down, you'll live a happier life. Happier life, so things don't go your way. You know what? I don't deserve it. I didn't work for it. Easy come, easy go, as people say. You'll just have a happier life, because so much of our disappointment and our frustration is when we're chasing quixotic castles. If you're literary, Don Quixote, quixotic castles that aren't ours, that we believe we should occupy, and all of a sudden we realize, you know what, it's not mine. I'm just, happiness under my own 2 feet, look beneath my own 2 feet, I control that, I'll work for it, whatever I get, I don't have to all of a sudden chase odysseys beyond my 4 parameters. Okay, so, I don't know how we get to that, but...
I think we got to bite
by your, by your diversion.
The source.
Okay, so, everyone quiet, you especially, okay, no digressions, no diversions, we're going to finish. Oh, we're not going to finish today, but we'll finish part of it today. What does Hashem have to have a lot to do with it? So what does Hashem say? Hashem says, walk away from your pagan addiction, show some courage, okay? Most underrated trait of religion, be courageous, okay? That doesn't mean stand down armies, and just be courageous. Push yourself out of your comfort zone, take choices in life that are hard. If you never make a choice in life with your knees wobbling, you never lift. Just because your knees are wobbling doesn't mean you shouldn't take the choice. Those are the choices you got to take. Now, how do you know when to take them? Don't ask me. But don't avoid choices because your knees wobble. That just means you're on the cusp of something great, and every great decision is walking into the big, dark unknown. And when you walk into the big, dark unknown, your knees are wobbling. But That's the price you pay for being great. That's the price you pay for getting to the next stage. You got to wobble. So your knees wobble, butterflies in your stomach. I've been there. One day I'll tell you. I did the knee wobbling, did the butterfly in the stomaching. Best decisions of your life. Follow the butterflies. Okay? That sounds like a poem, but it's follow the butterflies. A good way to make decisions. Okay. Hashem says, show a little courage. Of course, they're spineless. It's not their fault. You can blame them, Hashem says. Vayamrubi, they rebelled. Lo avu l'shmo alai, ishik v'seinim lo eshlichu. So what does Hashem say? Line number 4. Anyone remember these words? It may sound familiar. Line number 4. Va'omar l'shpoch hamasi alehem, l'chalos api bohem b'toch eretz Mitzrayim. What do those words sound like? Va'omar l'shpoch hamasi alehem. Remember we say the night of Pesach, shpoch hamascha l'groyim asher lo yedeucha? We're lifting those words from Yechezkel. And in its original incarnation, there was a threat against us. Hashem said, you don't deserve to be redeemed. Because you refuse my solicitation. You take the first step. I don't want to redeem you. You're out. The night of Pesach, we pull a... See, the problem is we have to start accepting girls to Migdalos in Brooklyn because I can't speak Brooklynese. But in Brooklynese, we used to call it a switcheroony. A switcheroony. Say one thing, give another thing. I'll tell you someday about when you fly a switcheroony. So, Pesach night, we pull a switcheroony. Say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, remember that threat that you posed to us? Pour your wrath on those wicked nations. Don't punish us. Okay, but here it goes. You have a question that Shmos doesn't dare to pose. We don't deserve to be redeemed. Shmos smudges this, fudges it over with nice ice cream and icing on the cake and cherries on top, and we love Hashem and Hashem loves us. That's not happy. It's a little ugly here. Got pockmarks here. This isn't photoshopped. This is the real raw story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. So why are we redeemed from Mitzrayim, says Yechezkel? Here's the answer, and you don't get in Shmos. Va'as l'man shemi, line number 4. Levilti achel in yagrem shemi b'socham. I didn't do it for you. You didn't deserve it. But at that point of history, so much of Hashem and his presence in this world had been invested in the state of the Jewish people. 400 years worth. We were aligned with Hashem. People saw Hashem through us. And to eliminate us at that point in history, though we may have deserved it, would have led to a regression of Hashem's presence in this world. What do we call a regression of Hashem's presence in this world? No, that's a voluntary contraction. What do we call a regression, obscuring of Hashem's presence in this world? Two words. Give you a hint. It starts with Chilul, and that's with Hashem. Chilul Hashem is any regression of His presence. Not just broad, dramatic activities, but any time Hashem's presence diminishes, as just like any time His presence augments. It's a Kiddush Hashem. Anytime you bring Hashem into this world, you read a page of Gemara, you bring Hashem into this world. The naked eye may not see it, the headlines may not cover it, but Hashem is more in this world because people know more of His will. There's a metaphysical stage, not just a political and social stage. Learn to operate on both stages. Don't spend all your time on the stage that everyone can see, because there's another stage to human history called metaphysics and activity that no one can see, but we know make differences. So be part of both stages. Decide which stage you want to occupy more. Be part of both stages. So Hashem didn't redeem us because we deserved it. He redeemed us because the alternative was unacceptable. So He had to redeem us. What happened in Europe in the years between 1940 and 1945 was the single greatest Chilul Hashem since the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. I don't have time to catalog what happened over 2,000 years of misery and bloodshed and torture. But nothing compared to the systematic attempt to eliminate anything and everything Jewish in the streets of Europe. The Nazis were not just assaulting Jews, they were assaulting Hashem in this world, in his presence. Where was Hashem during those dark years? We know, because we're people of faith, so we see behind the screen of history. We know Hashem operates sometimes in obscurity, in darkness. He's dimmed, but he's there. But most people couldn't see him. Maniacs running the world, killing indiscriminately, genocidal cleansing of our people, attempts to. No one can establish historical equivalency between the Holocaust and the State of Israel. It's ridiculous, it's unfair, it's immoral. Rav Amitel's legacy, one of his Holocaust legacies, is the Holocaust is too broad to neatly wrap human imagination around. It's just, you can talk about it, but don't concoct simplistic formulations. The Holocaust was this, the Holocaust was that. It's a field. It's larger than life. It's larger than any synopsis or any principle. Let's study it, learn from it, but don't generalize and sweeping conclusions and simplify. It's silly and it's disrespectful. By the way, on the subject of disrespect, I talked before about conversation enders. Bureaucracy is not a conversation ender. It's not democratic. Okay, not democratic. Let's see. So maybe you want something a little bit less democratic. Don't be pushovers. Don't just fall into people's assumptions, all these platitudes. Maybe the platitude itself should be examined. Okay, it's not democratic. And therefore, we have other values. I'm in support of democracy, but to a limit. It has to be merged with other values. For me, conversation enders are people who use Holocaust words to describe non-Holocaust situations. That is intellectually dishonest, morally repugnant, and far more important to protect than any conversation we could possibly be having, including the future of the free world. So the second you call someone a Nazi, as far as I'm concerned, conversation is over. You've lost your right to have a conversation. Your historical myopia and your moral degeneracy means that this conversation stops. Period. Chas v'shalom, a Jew. In my wildest imagination, I can't wrap my head. As far as I'm concerned, a Jew who calls another Jew a Nazi has walked out on Jewish history. That's how terrible that crime is. And you should learn to call it that and learn to see it. I can't imagine a more terrible crime. Now that I say it, should be obvious to you. How in your wildest imagination? What type of Jew are you? Excuse me for saying it. I don't care how religious you are. Your religion is predicated on such a flawed, historically degenerate perspective that it's toxic. And I also don't like the word ghetto. I also don't like the word concentration camps. I know the Hendon ghetto and the Golders Green ghetto and the Penn ghetto and just... Ghettos were not places with high concentrations of restaurants and mikvahs. Oh, there's a lot of restaurants in Golders Green, so it's a Jewish ghetto. Ghettos were miserable, grotesque, hideous, nightmarish people dying on the streets, starving, living on top of one another, being shot, having their beards torn off, pregnant women having their babies shot. Why would you even use that word? Where's your historical perspective to use the word Yeah. How many words are in the English language? Come up with a different word. Come up with a better word. Just the words you use create the mentalities under which you operate. Be careful about your words. Think carefully. Don't fall lazily into words that phrases and labels and stereotypes and platitudes and all these. I'm modern orthodox and I'm ultra orthodox. Right? Just drill beneath the phrases and understand, because if you simply and lazily fall victim to phrases, you'll fall victim to the lazy thought behind those phrases. So work at phrases and use the right terms for yourself with clarity and precision and balance rather than just using stupid little phrases that people use. Don't ever, for the rest of your life, use left and right. Why would you do that? Since when are people so dichotomized? If you're left, then you fall into these 10 ideas. And you're like, why in the world? And what does left and right even mean? I don't belong to anything. I'm a Jew. I live in Israel. I'm happy to invite any Israeli to my home. And I vote for these ideas and for those. They call me left, right. Why? Why are those simple definitions even around? Because people need lazy, simple, you're this, you're that, it's demonstration to the left, the peace camp, the war. Rabbeinu Shlomo, they're identity blockers. They're not identity builders. They'll block your identity. So all of a sudden, you're dealing with the darkest period in Jewish history. And a Chilul Hashem of that magnitude required a Kiddush Hashem of some response. There was no equivalency or symmetry of Chas V'Shalom, but we were redeemed in 1948 to a degree, even though we didn't deserve it, because it's hard to know. I don't feel morally capable of saying we deserved it over the Rambam's generation or over the Kiva's generation or over... I'm not going there. I don't feel confident enough to say that. But I do know that the Holocaust was a shift. And it required a shift. And in the 5 minutes, I'll tell you a great story so I can have some discipline without my mind wandering off into all these digressions. And when I thought about Yechezkel Malkov. It was about 20 years ago, roughly. There was a ceremony commemorating the liberation of, I think it was Auschwitz. Leaders from across the world were invited, including Jewish leaders, as well as Israeli leaders. And the Israeli government requested a symbolic flyover. Train tracks at Auschwitz. Initially, it was stiff opposition. Auschwitz is a cultural site, historical site. Can't introduce weapons again. And then a couple of weeks later, the Israeli Air Force was, the same Air Force you saw yesterday, was invited to participate in military exercises with the Polish Air Force. In a Polish city, I think it was Redan or something. And the squadron leader of the Israeli Air Force, to his credit, a Sephardic Jew, whose family wasn't even imperiled by the Holocaust. Most Sephardim didn't suffer the Holocaust. Very few, very couple. The Greeks, Italians. That's what makes Sephardic Jewry so different in so many ways than Ashkenazic Jewry. Basically, everything that happened to the Ashkenazim over the last 200 years, good, bad, neutral, didn't happen to the Sephardim. They didn't have the Yeshiva movement, then the Muslim Hasidim, secularization, reform, conservative, Holocaust. It's a completely different trajectory, for better or for worse. A lot of positives, a lot of negatives, and we're starting to learn about how to better synchronize some of those. So he said, Israeli jets will only fly in Radom, this military exercise, if they first fly in Auschwitz. Namely, we're not coming. And if we come, we're staying. And of course, the Polish parliament buckled, because they needed our air force. And I remember listening to the radio, this was before internet, listening to the radio report. He pulled his team into formation in the skies above Auschwitz, and he swooped down over those train tracks that had witnessed such horror. I saw, on my news feed, my Google news feed, there was a picture in Yom HaShoah of some, tourists that were there, hopefully not Jewish tourists, and one of the girls was, sprawled out, taking a selfie on the train tracks at Auschwitz, Bernie Shalom. No one here will be like that. But again, the selfie culture and the self-promotional culture, learn to see in hideous and extreme examples the same dangers you're going to face in more subtle ones. No one here is going to take a picture on a train tracks at Auschwitz. But you may, because you got to get that picture out, take pictures in places that you shouldn't. So what's a place you shouldn't take a selfie? Here's a good one, Har HaBayis. One of my oppositions going to Har HaBayis, it's become a selfie opportunity rather than a place you walk up with fear and seriousness and hesitation. I'm not saying you should or shouldn't. But ask yourself, can you think of 5 locations in your life you shouldn't be taking a picture? It doesn't just have to be the Har HaBayis. 5 conditions in life. It's not an opportunity for a picture. Because we document so much through pictures, the Instagram culture, that there's no filter on what we do or don't take pictures of. And that's the most extreme version. I'm only going to take a picture at Auschwitz. But you're seeing a monstrous expression of more subtle trends that we struggle with. And that's why these monstrous situations are so important, because they show us things in sharp relief. So this train checker, when he's such horror, he pulls his team and he swoops down and he says, Gicha, Gicha is a sortie. Gimel Yud Chet Hei. Gicha Achat Avor Am Yisrael. Gicha Achat Avor Eretz Yisrael. Gicha Achat Avor Korbanot HaShoah. And I'm listening to him and saying, in 1944, how desperate were we for one flight? In 1944, the skies of Europe were in complete Allied control. The Luftwaffe was no more. It had been dismantled. How many bombing missions were conducted in World War II? You check that and look at it. How many tons of dynamite were dropped on Europe in World War II? All we asked of Eisenhower and Roosevelt and our good friend Winston, your buddy, all we asked... Just praying. Everybody would tell me to do that to me. So, George, where was Reagan? Nash, your buddy. You're always like, I don't know Reagan. Why fell on face? I'm my best friend. But I was the one American in the room. I always got it. So, you got to take it for all your friends. All we did was we pleaded for one flight, one bombing mission. Now, again, I want to be intellectually honest with you. I don't want to be demagogic. There is a lot of historical questioning, like how effective the bombing of the train tracks to Auschwitz would have been, because they could have built it the next day. But at least the people pleading at the time believed that bombing train tracks from Budapest ghetto to Auschwitz, remember, Budapest was one of the last scenes of the Nazi invasion. So in 1944, spring of 1944, till around the end of the war, 45, 750,000 Jews were exported to death in the Budapest ghetto to the gas chambers of Auschwitz. And if the train tracks had been dismantled and followed the line of argument and not rebuilt, so you're not going to kill 750,000 Jews. How many would have died based on the typhus? How many would have died based on starvation? How many would have died shooting? You're not getting to, you need the machinery of death to kill those numbers. And in 1944, 1945, 750,000 Jewish lives were not worth one uncontested flight. And I can't imagine a Chilul Hashem greater than that. And here it was, 60 years later, and we had our flight, and we had our Air Force, and we had our Kiddush Hashem, which we call the State of Israel. And I felt as if I was living through Yechezkel Parakaf. So I don't know if we deserve to be redeemed. It's a good question. It's a fair question. Ask yourself fair questions. Learn to be fair with yourself. Honest with yourself. The only route to truth. Ask yourself hard questions. Don't take easy answers. Don't give yourself discounts. Tell yourself stories. They pad your ego. In the short run, they upholster your identity. But it's false identity. Good question. Do we so deserve to be redeemed? But one thing I know. The State of Israel is a Kiddush Hashem. Not just the amount of Torah that's being learned, but in the rise of our people. Think globally. How we have changed 10 million people. Whatever the numbers I can. Started with 600,000 in 1948, the amount of people at Har Sinai. Now we've grown by, 15 times. That's not normal. The economic growth, the military growth, the cultural growth. Democracy is a hard thing. Remember, democracy is a consensus. You don't flip the switch on democracy. Remember, 75 years after American democracy, they fought a bloody civil war. We're not going to get to a bloody civil war, but there's a natural convulsions of democracy. It's called balance of power. That's basically what's happening. Traditional. In Israel, it's balance of power. With jet fuel being poured on the fire. It's called religious secular. So it's a multi-layered web. And that's why it's so hard to navigate, because there's so many nooks and crevices. Okay, we'll pass this also. Don't worry. History girls, not headlines. Okay, history, not headlines. Okay, so we have to end now. We got through one source. Okay. I guess maybe we'll talk about this tonight a little. Seems like interesting stuff, but... Okay. Have a good Shabbos. Anything special happening here for Shabbos?